What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. I'm your host, Katie Helper, and I'm here with Gabe Pacheco.
Hello, everybody.
You can find the Katie Helper Show on SoundCloud, on iTunes, on Patreon, and at Patreon, you just become members. It's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, and on iTunes, leave us a review. How's it going, Gabe?
I'm feeling really good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really excited about this week's episode.
Yeah, so excited. You look tan.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I went out to the Hamptons.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm a one percenter adjacent.
Yeah, what's the deal with that?
Well, one of my good friends is a tutor, and their tutor company has a whole bunch of clients out there.
Wow.
And yeah, the one percenters, their kids need constant stimuli and constant learning.
So it's like babysitter tutors or just like friend tutors?
So I went out and stayed at the house where all the tutors live.
There's a tutor house.
Yeah, they got to rent a house for all these people.
I want to live in a tutor house. I wonder if it's, you know, what would be interesting is if the tutor house was a tutor house. How you like that architecture joke? I'm here all.
I like a nice, awesome. I like a nice ranch style house.
Right. For ranchers or for tutors.
Yeah.
Or mission style. I do like mission style.
I just hit the microphone with my glasses.
Yeah. We want full transparency.
I just need everybody audience to know what that sound was.
Right. Not his schnoz. It was not a schnoz collision.
So
all right. Yeah.
We're cooking.
We're cooking.
You guys like our loose understanding of architecture?
So it's over the summer?
Yeah.
It's like summer school or catching these kids up or whatever.
They're constantly learning.
Falling behind.
Yeah, they're always falling behind. Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's where, you know, when kids from lower economic backgrounds, you know, during the summer times, they just forget everything that they learned. And then rich kids go to France or they like go and play tennis in Mallorca.
Right.
And then they come back with all of these enriched experiences, right, as well as having 2 or 3 weeks of being tutored in French.
Wow.
So, you know, who's going to succeed?
Probably. Right? It's unclear. It's a toss-up.
Who gets a heads up?
Right. You know? Who gets the leg up?
The leg up.
Yeah.
But you know, the rich kids also suffer from affluenza.
Exactly.
So they're more likely to run over people driving drunk or Brock Turner somebody behind a dumpster.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are the places.
Boundaries, that, poor guys. Well,
right. They don't have any boundaries. Yeah, so
very hard.
So they get a lot more enrichment in school, but they get no moral or ethical or impulse
guidelines.
Control.
Yeah, no impulse. It's very hard to be that. It's very hard, especially when you're in the Hamptons, you want to run around and maybe you want to drive to a restaurant and
well,
you may want to drink while you're there.
I don't know what they're doing. I had a good time in the Hamptons, though. I had a couple lobster rolls.
I love lobster rolls.
Yeah, I got really sunburned, but just on the top of my feet.
How did that happen?
Well, I got too cocky.
Yeah, you let your Mexican pride.
Yeah.
That Mexican pride will get you every time.
Well, you know me. I don't like to tan anyway. I don't like premature aging.
Right.
So I slather my whole body in a SPF, whatever.
70,000?
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, if you watch RoboCop, the first RoboCop, one of my favorite scenes is this interstitial sketch where they show a woman who's like, since the ozone layer disappeared. Now use this. And it's like, she just puts this bright blue, like thick suntan lotion all over her whole body. Mm.
They say 20 seconds in the California sunshine is too much these days. Ever since you lost the ozone layer. But that was before sunblock 5000. Just apply a pint to your body and you're good for hours.
She's like, see you at the pool.
See you by the pool.
That's kind of how I am when I go to the beach.
Right.
But I forgot to put some on the tops of my feet.
You forgot your feet.
That's it.
You forgot the feet.
Don't forget. Awful. Start at the feet.
Yeah.
Like, get your feet, get head your to ears.
Toes. Yes. But you got your ears this time?
No.
Did you get ear burnt also?
I got ear and foot burned.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The rest of me is still nice and
bronzed. You are pretty bronzed. So I would think that you probably don't. You have some bronze hubris.
For all of our listeners out there, just imagine me as a bronzed Adonis.
Yeah, exactly. I call him bronzed Adonis.
12-pack Pacheco.
Yeah, 12-pack Pacheco. I feel like it's an injustice because I'm Jewish and I haven't been to the Hamptons in a long time. And we want to play you a great episode that we recorded live. Hot, live.
At Caveat.
Great venue. We spoke to Thomas Frank, who is a writer. In fact, we give you his whole bio during the actual show, but he's great. It was a good time. And we're just going to play it. Let's just roll it. Let's get to it.
Why are we wasting your time? All right, everybody.
All right, here you go. Here's our show, live taping June 30th with Thomas Frank at Caveat.
What a beautiful turnout. Look at everybody in here. Look at this. I can't see the second row, but the first row is very sexy. So, welcome everybody to a live recording of the Katie Halper Show here at Caveat. What a beautiful place. Thank you. Welcome. And it's my privilege and honor to introduce you to your host tonight, Katie Halper, the one and only.
Thanks, Gabe. And it's my privilege and honor to introduce you guys to Gabe Pacheco, co-host, one and only.
Wow. I like this thing that we're doing where we kind of like big up each other.
I know, yeah.
It's pretty good. Something new.
Yeah, we usually talk a lot of crap about each other. But what makes tonight different from every other night?
Yes.
Okay, no Jews in the audience. All right, cool. This is good. So. Oh, good. Thank you. ask someone about it. It's like, it's Passover. It's a Jewish Easter thing. Okay. We're really excited to be talking about one of our favorite books.
Yeah.
By one of our favorite authors.
We love reading.
We love reading.
We like people that write books.
We like both of those things. They often go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And how many of you guys have been to a live taping before of the Katie Halper Show, by the way? Okay, good. Great. Awesome. Okay, cool.
Cool. And if it's your first time here, can I get a whoop whoop?
Wow. Okay, cool. Well, this is a safe space for everyone.
Yeah.
No matter what. And this week was a mixed week. How was your week, Gabe?
My week? Well, you know,
you just sounded like you were in a play.
Let's just accentuate the positive things today. Today was amazing. Something really profound. I got to see, I got to cover marches happening all over the country today to get families back together. So that was really cool. I was at SiriusXM earlier with Jorge Oliveras for Affirmative Reaction, and we got to see and talk to people all over the country trying to bring these get these babies out of cages. So that was cool. That was a good thing.
That's always a net positive.
Yeah,
babies out of cages.
Babies out of cages, always positive. I'm just trying to look at the bright side. So you know, because we just started the show, I'm sure things are gonna spiral out of control soon when we talk about the state of the world. But the marches were good.
Also, Ocasio-Cortez won. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's more good news.
Yeah.
Yeah. In case you guys don't know, she was running in a congressional primary, and she beat the grandfather from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I believe is what Gabe called him, in a moment of slight ageism. But, Ocasio-Cortez won her congressional primary against Joe Crowley.
Yeah.
And, She ran on abolishing ICE. and providing Medicare for all. That's great. But also, do not underestimate the effect of appearing on the Katie Halper Show, which she did.
She got that bump.
She got that Katie Halper Show bump. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking you're being crazy. You're being an egomaniac. It's an isolated incident. Yeah, sounds like it. Except, you know who else won? Ben Jealous. Yeah. Also a guest on the Katie Halper Show.
He also got that bump.
That Katie Halper Show bump, yeah. KHSB. And going back a little bit, Larry Krasner also. I'm just saying, the common denominator, we're not going to go over the people who've been on the show who lost, because that's not germane. but yeah, Ocasio was great. Very exciting. She wants to abolish ICE. She totally is a trendsetter with that. Now everyone wants to abolish ICE.
Yeah.
Also, all you feminists on Twitter who were like mad that people didn't cover Ocasio, you didn't cover her either. So I didn't go after anyone on Twitter because I'm a good person, but as a feminist who did cover her and a feminist ally who did cover her, all it takes is a tweet. Just cover your asses next time someone awesome runs. And then you can make fun of like the white straight men who didn't cover her. Just a PSA. Speaking of white straight, I don't know if I want that transition for our guest. speaking of really great champions of the working class and progressive politics and a solver of problems, we're going to bring out our guest. This guy, you probably have heard of him. His name is Thomas Frank. He's a journalist. He's a writer. He's an historian. He wrote the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? He wrote the book, Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. And his latest book is a collection of essays, Rendezvous with Oblivion. He also is the founder of The Baffler magazine. He writes for places like Harper's and The Guardian. So put your hands together for Thomas Frank.
Yes. How are y'all doing today? It is so nice to be here in New York City.
It's so great to have you here. Do you feel comfortable as a Kansanian?
Kansan is the word.
Kansan, sorry. I was trying to
keep
you New York flourish.
A little bit of trivia for you. So in, there's a river called the Arkansas River, and that's what it's called in Colorado and in Arkansas and places. And in Kansas, it's called the Arkansas River.
Oh, that's nice. Arkan-do. Well, Thomas, thank you for coming. And can you tell us a little bit about... well, you want to start, like, you know the movie Memento, where they start, like, backwards and go forward? Sorry, spoiler alert. Can you start with, you have a really, the whole book is really good. All the essays are good.
What
I reviewed
book?
All
what
of them.
What book is that,
I
Katie? What
them.
Is the title of
oh,
it?
Oh, Rendezvous with Oblivion.
Awesome. Where did that, where do you think he got that title?
One of his essays, which is called Rendezvous with Oblivion.
Yeah. But I mean, like, for real, because, you know, when you make up headlines, you know. It comes from a speech by Franklin Roosevelt. I am so old now. I'm the only one that remembers
He remembers
things.
Sitting there by the fire listening to him.
With the radio, the great big, you know, giant AM radio, you know, with the gigantic, they would have these gigantic speakers in them and it would make the whole floor shake. And,
yeah, exactly.
Great subwoofers.
Yeah, and, anyone like this, right?
And Roosevelt said, I think he was talking about the, you know, the Depression, World War II was underway, and he said, this generation has a rendezvous with destiny. And it's one of his sort of, at the time, was one of his best-known phrases. And anyhow.
So in lieu of destiny,
we have a different rendezvous, folks.
Are we staring into the abyss right now?
You know, yeah. That's sort of what I meant. Yeah, I meant it as a downer. Yeah, and I think that is accurate. I mean, I am. I'm a born pessimist, and I've spent my career being pessimistic, and all of my worst predictions keep coming true.
Do you think there's a causal effect?
A what?
A causal effect? Like, if you didn't predict it?
You know, I wonder about that. I wonder about that. If, like, I'm sure we'll get to that at some point, you know, like, people get blamed for it. But I certainly have a lot
You're
of guilt.
You're just the messenger.
I feel very guilty about it.
About being right?
Well... It's not a rational reaction, okay? But look, I wrote about this 20 years ago. I mean, the situation that we're in now. And it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse all the time. And yeah, I have a certain
I do have a feeling of guilt about it. And I don't know why, and I don't know what to do. But I'm just going to ignore that.
This you
know,
is
that's
good.
That's what they invented Armagnac for.
I wish we had a couch. We could get really into where this guilt comes from. When did you start feeling guilty? Well, you must also be able to feel another a more satisfying emotion. Maybe I'm projecting, which is I told you so. Although you'd probably rather not be able to feel that. And have been wrong.
Well, I think you're getting close to it there, but it's like, it's cold comfort to say that to, you know, when you're trying to, I have to live in this country.
Right.
You know, I have children, you know, I want their lives to be happy. I want everyone's lives. And it's just, it's immensely distressing to me. Can I tell you a funny anecdote?
No. Yes.
So when I was writing What's the Matter with Kansas, this would have been in 2002 or 2003. And at one point I went up to Winnetka. I lived in Chicago at the time. And I went up to Winnetka for a book event. And I met a very senior Democratic Party figure. And I bought his book and I got it autographed and I was talking to him. I was chatting with him, really nice guy. And I'm not going to tell you who it was, but he said... I said, you know, I'm writing a book about Kansas and how they've gone so far to the right, which it was remarkable even then. This is when they had just finished having this fight over the theory of evolution in Kansas. And I was like,
the jury's still out.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what made me want to write the book. That's what got me started on it. And so I was telling him about this and he said, you know, they've pushed too far. The pendulum is going to swing back the other way. And I thought I'm like you know, of course that seemed very reassuring, but I've spent all the years since then thinking about like how incredibly wrong that theory of history is. Yeah, waiting for the pendulum to come and rescue you. You know, we don't have to do anything. It'll fix itself all by its own. You know, we don't have to do anything. We don't have to raise a finger. It's just gravity. It's just gravity, folks. It's geometry.
No, what I've learned from Star Wars is that it's all about balance.
Right.
If things get too dark, they, you know. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Historically speaking, moderate centrism always beats right-wing radicalism.
Oh yes, that's right. Because but this is also, by the way, the allure of political science. It's a kind of geometry. It's just, everything is, you know, in this geometric relationship to, you know, and you can draw it out all out on a chart, and you can see that things have to come back. And you can also see that the swing voter, what they call the median voter, is people just like us. And so the parties have to I'm way outside. But I mean, people for nice professional class, white collar people in the suburbs, that's who both parties have to pay attention to. And this has just been proven completely and utterly wrong.
Right.
The entire discipline is built on that theory.
So
the median voter.
Why is that? So you have people who aren't idiots, right? You have smart people.
Because that's what they want to believe.
Why do they want to believe?
Because it prioritizes
them.
So
Chuck Schumer, right, during the 2016 elections, right, he said that we have to, for every white working, did he say white working class? Or just working?
Something like
anyway,
that.
Anyway, for any working class voter that we lose, we're going to get a moderate suburban Republican. Then you had Rendell, that really corrupt guy from Pennsylvania. He basically said the same thing.
The really awful thing is that these guys are older than me. They're extremely experienced. They understand politics. And they didn't know that there's more working class people than there are rich, affluent suburbanites.
Right.
Like, how can you not know that? How can you grow up in this country and be a politician and those are your voters and you don't know that?
Yeah, so how do they not know it? Is it they're too insulated?
They don't want to know that. I really don't want to go down this road, but this is the fight that I've been, this stupid crusade that I have been on for 20 years, and I'm sick of it, and I don't want to talk about it anymore, but...
Good night. Thanks for coming.
But it's just this. If the swing voter is not, in fact, your nice, affluent, suburban soccer mom or whatever, the office park dad, or, you know, you remember all the terms that they used to make up to describe these people. If that's not it, or that maybe they are swing voters, but there's not very many of them, and there's this other swing voter that's the white working class, and that's my, you know, what I've pointed out again and again and again and again, and going back to, you know, the 60s, that is your swing demographic. If that is true, how are you going to reach them? There's two ways. One is do the Bill Clinton thing, and you know, and the other
is what, dog whistle?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other, I mean, you'll get some of them that way, but whatever. It's ugly and it's gross. But the other way is move to the left on economic issues. And okay. they don't want to do that.
Okay, so let's say...
It's the simplest goddamn calculus in the world. It's the simplest equation in the world.
So let's take
How
a
do
vote.
You win the votes of working class people? Well, you speak to them on the issues that matter to them, which is always the same. It's jobs and the economy, always, always, always. So go out there and talk about, you know, universal health care. Go out there and talk about deindustrialization. You know, all this stuff. It's incredibly... simple. It's incredibly easy. It's incredibly straightforward. It doesn't make Goldman Sachs happy. It doesn't make Google happy. It makes JP Morgan very sad when you do those things.
Right.
And so they don't do them. Right. And they act as though it's like, well, who would ever think of doing something like that? That's absolutely crazy. They're, you know, and every rationalization that you can come up with, every kind of psychological trick to persuade themselves that they don't have to do that.
So Bill Clinton, apparently, during the election, threw his cell phone off of his balcony in his Arkansas mansion because he was so upset about how the Clinton campaign wasn't reaching out to the white working class. I don't know if you heard this
anecdote. I've never heard that, no.
Yeah. So his solution seemed to be like, why aren't you dog whistling or bullshitting better, right? Which also is not very sustainable. Wait,
isn't this a radio show?
Yeah, but oh yeah, it's a podcast. We can bleep it out.
Oh, okay.
We'll bleep it out, yeah.
I'm sorry. I used to work in radio for many years. And I
you didn't know in New York
know.
City you every radio station.
This is extreme.
Yeah.
Podcasting.
I mean, we are talking about swingers, right?
Yes.
Swing voters.
Safe harbor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Safe word. I don't know enough about that stuff to even make the jokes. So it seems like there are a couple of options. One is you totally neglect these voters, or you appeal to their worst...
Welfare reform. People don't remember what Clinton did to try to make himself appealing to that demographic, but welfare reform was one, mass incarceration was another. Right. His famous... humiliation of Jesse Jackson. Although that's something different. He was appealing to a different group with that. But it was, you know, famously humiliated Jesse Jackson. Now, remember when he did all these things and then throw NAFTA in there, which is a different thing, where he basically stabs these people in the back after they've worked their butts off to get him elected, you know, the unions and stuff like that. They used to have a saying in the Clinton days, they've got nowhere else to go.
Right.
And this is, if you're not old enough to remember, this was kind of the great journalistic mantra of that age. You always repeated
Person
that.
Well,
they've got nowhere. Very good. They've got nowhere else to go. And they would say this whenever he did something horrible to some core Democratic constituency. And do you want to hear my theory now?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to build up to this and say it at the very end of the show, but we're at the very start, and I'll say it now.
Yeah. Memento. Yeah.
So now that we know the swing group is, in fact, there's two groups that you have to pay attention to. And big surprise, it's the two groups that Bill Clinton humiliated. It's white working class union members, that kind of thing. And it's black voters who, by and large, a lot of them stayed home on Election Day 2016. So those are the groups that you got to get back. Those are the groups that you got to inspire, and you got to get them out voting for you. Who can you take for granted now? It's your nice liberal class, affluent suburbanites. The ones who are out there, you know, the never Trumpers.
Right.
They're not voting for Trump no matter what. No matter what.
Right.
I mean,
so now
they're
captive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So like basically people who were Republicans up until yesterday.
So you take the entire Clinton calculus and you flip it on its head.
Right. So there's one of the, I think, most dangerous...
I sense doubt from you, but I'm going to convince you of this by the end of the evening.
What do you mean? Wait, what doubt? If anything, I feel bad. I agree with you so much. Where's the tension? But where's the doubt? What's the doubt?
I do nothing.
Okay. No, what makes this exciting is that we can make fun of the same people together. I think we can all agree on that, as well as basically everything else. But one of the most dangerous narratives, I think, is the idea...
It's the radical centrists. That's who you take for granted. They've already said, you know... They're never, ever, ever in a million years voting for this guy. They're, you know, done and done.
And this idea that white working class voters and working class voters of other backgrounds have conflicting desires, which just isn't true. Like, there is this narrative, and it's a classic divide and conquer thing, right? Where what is good for the white working class isn't good for people of color, or other way around. And there's not
I hate to break it to you, but it's incredibly easy to find things that are good for both of them.
I know. Like every single thing that's actually like social welfare at all.
Yeah.
Ocasio up in the Bronx
named, she ran on a whole bunch of them. Turns out they're really popular.
The only thing is that you can appeal in a racist or anti-racist way, but there's nothing, I mean, I say this on every episode, sorry, but if anything, all these programs only disproportionately help the most marginalized, right? Yeah. Like if you get how racism works, you get that raising the minimum wage helps everyone, but disproportionately women and people of color, because those are the majority of minimum wage workers.
And like making it easy to form unions again, that's going to be good for all kinds. I mean, there's so many issues like this.
Right.
But they're incredibly easy to find. There's nothing tricky about them. They are very straightforward. And you embrace those things and you win. The problem is that you don't get to, you know, retire with a fat bank account and build a fantastic presidential library somewhere, all those things that presidents, I mean, they all expect it. By the way, okay, I'm going to change the subject on you again.
Okay, cool.
There's an essay in Rendezvous with Oblivion about presidential libraries. So I've went to a whole bunch of them. I went to the two Bush presidential libraries and the Clinton presidential library. And I didn't mention it in there, but I also went to the Truman Library because it's in Kansas City, or it's in a suburb of Kansas City. And it cost something like $1.5 million to build.
Oh, I thought you were going to say to get into.
No, so Truman, he was not a wealthy man. Right. He was the last president that didn't go to college. And they didn't have pensions for presidents back then. And all he had was a captain in the artillery during World War I or something. And so that's all he had.
So he started doing like breakdancing in subways.
No, he wrote his memoirs is what he did.
Oh, okay.
But that's what they instituted giving presidents pensions at that point, because it was otherwise he was going to like basically die in poverty. But he somehow raised enough money to build a presidential library, and it was $1.5 million. And the George W. Bush presidential library, something like I think it's half $1 billion. It's like $500 million. Or something like
that's
that.
W or the father? Sorry.
W, the latest one.
So there's like really good elevators.
They go up. Each one is more expensive than the preceding one. So the Bill Clinton one was pretty expensive, and then the George W. one is even more.
Right.
And there's all the sort of trophy architecture and
Have you seen any of W's art, by the way?
That had not come out yet at the time, and so none of it was on display when I went there.
Okay.
But it was, I had a theory about the George W. Well, you'll see, it's all in Rendezvous, but I had a theory about, so George W. Bush is an extraordinarily bad president.
Mm-hmm.
And these, a lot of the kids don't know that, right?
Oh, right, because anyone who's not Trump is now the best person ever.
I know.
President George Bush, yeah.
So this guy's an unusually disastrous president. You know, you've got the Iraq War, you got Hurricane Katrina, you got the lobbying scandal, and you got the financial crisis to top it all off. You know, it's just like one awful disaster after another. And so I would hate to be the architect that had to design his museum, because the challenge is, how do you defuse the public's hatred for this guy? Like, how do you keep people from just like exploding in rage as they tour this museum? And so what they did, it's kind of interesting, because they went to great lengths to figure this out. This is my theory. And it's like a nuclear reactor where you have the fissile material, and then you have the cadmium rods in between to keep, to keep everything from blowing up. So you look at the exhibit about the Iraq War, and you're like, God damn it, that was so dumb,
even
costly, and you wrecked that country. And then the next exhibit is about his dog Barney. And what a lovable guy he is. And there's a letter in a vitrine from Bono. Bono wrote to George W. Bush, and it's raining. You're like, oh, he must have been a good guy. And then it's the Hurricane Katrina exhibit. Next, you're like, oh, how did he not see this coming? What kind of a doofus was this guy? And then the next exhibit is like, he gave all this money for diseases in Africa, malaria. And so you're like, that's good. That's nice. And the financial crisis,
Well, also, he gave all this money, but he also made it abstinence-only stuff, so he killed a bunch of people in the process.
Yeah, there's not an exhibit
on that.
They
don't have an altar, they don't have a shrine to the people he killed.
And the Clinton Library, I'll just tell my one joke about the Clinton Library. It looks like it's super high, it's very...
It's a big obelisk.
Like the Washington Monument, right? That would be appropriate, but it's this high concept architecture. You know, it's this glass and steel, gigantic structure glass jutting steel. Out over the, what's the river that runs through Little Rock? Is it the Arkansas?
Danube.
Yeah, I don't even remember.
Danube.
And it's supposed to be a bridge, right? It's supposed to be the goddamn bridge to the 21st century. Remember how he promised he'd get us over that bridge, right. And here we are, so be thankful to him.
Yeah.
So someone pointed out to me what it actually looks like is a shipping container. It's his free trade policies, right, yeah. Right? There it is, up in the air over Little Rock.
It's
you know,
like a
illuminated
NAFTA
at night. You know, this is the device that ruined your town.
Right.
Here it is, folks.
Yeah, let's hear it for NAFTA. I knew we had really pro-NAFTA audience.
So, by the way, when you know Clinton and Bridge to the 21st Century, I saw him say those words with my own eyes. That was the first political convention I ever attended in 1996 in Chicago. And I was up in the, you know, the where they put the journalists, right. Up in the cheap seats. And I craned way over him, and I could see him, and he, yeah, I
did
saw.
Did he smile, go like that to you?
He was going like this, you know, he was waving.
That's a slippery slope from that to something else. Question though for you. Part of I think why your perspective is so interesting is because you yourself used to be a Republican.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your evolution, or honestly, it's a devolution, depending on when you ask me, because I think libs are kind of worse. But anyway,
where I come from,
certainly more infuriating because you expect more.
Where I come from, the first thing I should say to get myself off the hook is, I was 15.
Yeah, you were born into it. You can't
and
help it.
And everyone where I grew up was and is a Republican in Kansas City. In Kansas. Now, in Missouri at the time, Missouri was a Democratic state at the time. It since has the creeping Kansification of, right. You know, the entire Midwest. They took over Missouri about 10 years ago. And, you know, and now it's what's next? It's Wisconsin. Wisconsin is now a battleground state. It's like it blows them. It just makes you crazy. But when I was a kid, you lived in Kansas. You're a Republican. All the adults I knew were Republicans. And I would watch Ronald Reagan used to, nobody remembers this anymore. He used to be on the radio all the time, like you, Katie.
Yeah.
He had a radio show, and he would do these little dollops of folk wisdom and political,
insights.
Insights, very short, like Reader's Digest style. And there's another part of the conservative world that we've completely forgotten, Reader's Digest. Does anybody read that anymore?
My aunt used to read it.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I used to read it. It had those great Adventure in Real Life or whatever it was called. And then the next story would be something about how, you know, college students are crazy.
Just or, common sense.
People in the third world hate our guts.
Right.
You know. anyhow, so Reagan had this. He would do these little snippets, very reassuring. He had this wonderful voice, and I decided at some point, and this is, you know, the hostage crisis is going on. Jimmy Carter, a man that we all admired, you know, because he seemed like a down-home guy. He was a pious man. He was an admirable man in many ways. Just seemed like he was not up to the situation. And when you are 15, those kind of, how would I put it? It's like a stereotype vision of history. You know, we have a weak president. We need a strong one. We're, you know, these terrible things are happening. We need this reassuring guy.
Right.
And I bought into Reaganism in a big way when I was 15. And so that transition from Carter to Reagan when I was young seemed so significant and seemed so meaningful. You know, that liberalism had run its course. And it was weak and ineffectual. Inflation is out of control. And here comes, you know, this handsome man, you know, all this crap. And, of course, I got over it. I got over it very quickly. But you know who never did? Trump. I mean, this is Trump's whole take on Obama is Reagan versus Jimmy Carter. And Make America Great Again, that's swiped directly from Reagan.
Even though Obama gave props to Reagan for being a transformative
person. Well, everybody loves him, right?
I don't understand.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
So, I got over it. I got over it. You want to know how I got over it?
Oh, yeah.
I got a job.
Oh, okay.
I was a temp in Kansas City. I would type, right? I could type really fast. And I got paid very, very, very little. And the bosses were jerks. And you discover right away on basically your first encounter with the reality of work that all of this stuff that he's been telling you, that is a myth. That is a Reader's Digest myth. It's just not true. What he's saying about capitalism, it's false.
Or the Contras.
Yeah, or any of that stuff. And then one thing led to another, and I started reading books, and...
See, you can make that joke because you're from Kansas, but I can't make that joke.
No, I always read books, but when I was a child, I loved like 19th century novels and stuff. But then I went away to college, and the thing that blew my mind was in college, my first year, was how incredibly broad the human experience is. And you suddenly, this stupid little world that you think is everything is, you know, is just infinitesimal. Among other things, I discovered, and this is especially interesting right now. So Reagan was a populist, lowercase p. You know, he had this way about him, this very folksy manner. And he, you know, again, go back to Reader's Digest. It was that kind of phony populism, this schlocky right. Norman Rockwell style. Norman Rockwell was a good guy, and I hate to, you know.
Take his name in vain.
Yeah. But it was that kind of thing. And so we all knew the word populism back then. And I went away to college, and I discovered that there actually had been something called populism with an uppercase P. And lo and behold, it had been in Kansas. I had never heard of that before. And I got really interested in it. And I started reading about it. It's fascinating. It was a homegrown leftist movement demanding basically this war on Wall Street and nationalization of the railroads and, you know, all of this government regulation of the economy in the interests of these very poor farmers. And I had no idea that this even existed. And I swear it was very early on that the light went on in my head that all of this stuff that Reagan is selling us and that before him Nixon was selling us, this is all a crock. They have taken something that's very noble, and they have swiped its symbols and its way of talking and its democratic impulse, and they have hitched that to something really awful, you know, the market. Mm. And this occurred to me very early on, but I didn't start writing about it until the 90s. But yeah, that was my awakening. It was in the early 80s.
Early 80s. And you then you wrote What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yeah, fast forward a bit.
Fast forward a bit. We could talk about your days as a historian. Do you want to talk about that?
I still am one. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, sorry, your days as an academic,
yeah.
Right. Wait, once a historian, it's like alcoholism. Once an historian, always an historian.
What is she saying?
That's a very exciting. I love history.
So.
No, I do. I study history. I'm a total history nerd. Let's talk about it.
Okay,
can talk about historiography.
Of course, I love history, and it's all I ever wanted to be in life from very early on was a historian, and much as I disagree with a guy like Richard Hofstadter, I admired him so much. His writing, wonderful. Christopher Lash, who's very out of fashion these days, super admired that guy. I thought he was the greatest thing in the world. Who am I leaving out? Some more historians from that sort of golden age, the 50s, the 60s.
Howard Zinn, of course, because they wrote for, and he's one too.
They wrote for a general audience.
Right, Howard Zinn.
These were intellectuals who wrote for a general audience. Who am I thinking of? Arthur Schlesinger.
Oh yeah.
And again, a controversial guy nowadays. But you read his History of the New Deal, and I read that in very early on, and I absolutely loved it.
While it was being passed, you were reading it. You were listening to FDR on the radio.
Yeah, right.
I'm just kidding. I'm not being ageist. It was just a
but that style of doing history, I really admired. So I went to college, studied history, went to graduate school, studied it some more, and got a PhD in the subject, American History, Cultural and Intellectual, 20th Century. And my dissertation was on the advertising industry in the 1960s. And maybe that sounds familiar to you. The Conquest of Cool, yeah. It's specifically about how the advertising industry embraced the counterculture, which is it's a really interesting topic. You'll have to take my word for it right now.
But no, it is,
It is absolutely fascinating. And I use that as a cross-section of that period, the late 50s, up to the early 70s. That was my subject. And I get out of history school. And, well, first of all, there's a big problem, which is that...
Jobs.
well, there's a larger problem, or I guess a longer term problem, which is that all, not just history, but all academic departments really are no longer interested in writing for the general public. You write for you write for your peers, you write for your colleagues. And if you read a lot of, you know, scholarly journals, this is what they do.
A lot of interrogating and unpacking. Mm-hmm.
Oh no, a lot of name checking and footnoting and calling out to one another, you know. And
but they use the word interrogating a lot.
Sure, there's a lot of buzzwords. Yes, I used to have a lot of fun making, you know, making fun of that stuff. That's what the Baffler was all about. We had a good time kicking those people around. Anyhow.
Got to do more of that.
Oh, they still do it. Right. I just, you know, I'm too old for that now. But anyhow, so the other problem was, of course, the job market had completely fallen apart by the time I got out of history school and had my PhD. And I discovered, and this is not only the case in history, I think history is actually better off than other disciplines, but all the humanities and a lot of the social sciences too, that there is this overproduction of PhDs. And meanwhile, the existing professors who are going out there to do the hiring have discovered that if they don't hire tenure track people and just hire adjuncts, that they can, you know, make their own workload much lighter, this kind of thing. And so I was able to get jobs as an adjunct, but I was not able to get anything tenure track, and it was extremely frustrating. And while I was doing this, you know, adjunct teaching, I was also writing for the Chicago Reader, one of our great alternative news weeklies. I think it still exists.
Yeah.
And I got paid more for a single story that I wrote for them than I did with an entire semester of adjunct teaching. And so here's the punchline, folks. I went into journalism for the money.
Right.
And I was like, I can curse?
Yeah.
I was like, fuck this shit. This is, you know. So I went into journalism.
All right, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a question around. So,
but I still am a historian. I actually even to this day read scholarly literature. And yes, everything I write has a historical grounding. So the one you've got, that one's a book of essays, so not so much. But like Listen Liberal is,
yeah.
I did a ton of research in the sociology of professionalism, which was a hot topic in like the late 80s.
My mom and uncle got into a fight over that, by the way.
Oh, really?
Over your book and the thesis, yeah.
Awesome.
We'll talk about it later. Yeah, yeah. My mom is more sympathetic. She really thinks you got to focus on the 1%. My uncle was more like, no,
it's the 10%.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the 10%.
My uncle was 10%. My mom's 1%.
Yeah.
In terms of who to vilify. Yeah.
What vilify all of them, you know?
Right.
Seriously.
But you got to focus on something.
But they're very different. And we'll talk about this in a little bit. But so, yeah, that book would not have been possible without doing a whole lot of reading in sociology. So just so you know.
Or, I mean, I have a similarly rigorous process, which is that I watch MSNBC and I try to suppress my gag reflex. So,
yeah. leading up to the election, I was reading Listen Liberal, and everybody I knew had a great faith that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. All the way up until election night, at least in New York. And you had predicted earlier, so I'm reading your book and I'm listening to the pundits and I'm very skeptical that she's gonna do anything, that she's gonna make it. But you predicted Trump's victory.
Well, not exactly. What I did was I wrote many times during the course of the campaign, this is how Trump is going to win. If Trump is no. I was watching what Trump was doing. It was very. I mean, come on, Katie. It was so obvious. You know what he was up to. It is possible that Look, you ask where the guilt comes from. A lot of it comes from watching Trump talk about the things he's talking about, and there's this flash of recognition, or watching Steve Bannon especially talk about what he's talking about, and you're like, oh shit, that's like from The Wrecking Crew, you know, a book that I wrote, or it sounds like it is, you know, it sounds like he's well, Trump's whole campaign strategy is from What's the Matter with Kansas, you know, reaching out on the trade issue,
right? Pseudo-populism.
And right down the and you can see it coming a mile away, and everybody could see it coming. And I wrote an article. I didn't write it. It was an interview
Ghost
I did in the New York Times. Anna Marie Cox wrote it. And it was in the New York Times, and the headline was Hillary needs to woo the working class, because this is obviously Trump's strategy. It is obvious. Right. Anybody can see this coming. And as the year, as that sort of awful year dragged on, it became more and more obvious that it was Trump's year. And even if Trump lost, we had turned a corner in this country, and Trumpism was here to stay. And I thought Hillary was going to pull it out until the very end, because all the polls said so. Right. And she had her amazing campaign staff. And you remember, like, Trump was endorsed by no newspapers.
KKK.
Like two news. Oh, yeah, right. But like two newspapers, you know, and Hillary was endorsed by hundreds of newspapers. Hillary had all these celebrities. Trump had almost no celebrities. Hillary had this amazing algorithm. Do you remember? She had everything. It was so high tech, and all the micro-targeting, and she had Eric Schmidt on the campaign jet, and, you know, on and on and on. It's like she had the, you know, she had twice as much money as him.
Right.
She had every advantage. But
she
I'll never forget
Blige.
when I went and voted for her in early voting in Maryland.
It's a safe space, guys. It's okay.
What?
I'm just kidding. You say that you get a lot of shit for voting for her. It's fine.
This is in the general election. I voted for Bernie in the primary, but I voted for
her
in the general.
Obviously, you wouldn't be on the show. Yeah.
Yeah. But, I'm not going to vote for Trump, for God's sakes. Right. Anyhow, so I voted for her, and I walked out of the polling place in Chevy Chase, Maryland, and I turned on my car. The radio was on, NPR was on, and they're like, we have breaking news. James Comey has just, and it was the goddamn Comey memo.
Right.
You know, that we're reopening the investigation of Hillary Clinton. I'm like, oh, shit. And it happened right after I cast my vote. So, yeah, I had the doubts, and then there's the story in there that I'm kind of proud of, but it's also, you know, whatever, a little
mixed
guilt
emotions.
Too. This only happens once or twice in a journalist's career. I wrote the essay, the Trump wins essay, and turned it in 2 days before the election. I went down to Florida, to my brother's house in Florida, and did the research for it. And Trump had these rallies. I mean, he bounced back from that incredible scandal, the you know, the groping tape.
And
I couldn't believe that.
Because he has the magic. He has like the perpetual get out of jail free card, which is that he already says he's a bad guy.
Exactly.
Kind of.
But I was watching his rallies on, you know, YouTube or on Facebook or whatever, and they were persisting right up to the last minute. And he appeared to be, the enthusiasm for him appeared to be building. I would turn on the TV. This is in Florida now, the swing state to end all swing states. There's no Trump TV commercials on because he doesn't have any money, right? His campaign is run on a shoestring, which is still hard for me to believe to this day. There's Hillary commercials wall to wall. Then you go out in the countryside and there's Trump signs everywhere. Something is going on. And so, yeah, I wrote that essay and...
people made fun of you for it too. People made fun of you for like changing your opinion on what was happening, which I think is just called being observant and living in the real world.
Yeah. And it's not something
smug
that
liberal.
And it's the angriest essay I ever wrote. It's highly polished. It was highly polished. It was ready to go. Turned it into the Guardian a couple days before the election, and they put it up 4 minutes after the AP called Wisconsin for Trump. And you know, it's a beautiful essay. It's very well written. And it had all the links.
Very
it had
typical.
It had all the links. You know,
characterized
by
typical humility. That yeah.
No, no. But
you go back and look.
That election caught everybody else in this country flat-footed. They're like, what do we do now? You know, it's like the New York Times. Everybody, get back in here. You know, they're all out.
Right.
They're all out drowning
their
sorrows.
Filet mignon, right.
So yeah. So I did something right.
Well, we had Ben Jealous on, as you know, because he's now the nominee. No, but we did have Ben Jealous on the day of the election. So there was you, Michael Moore, and Ben Jealous were three people who were actually entertaining the idea that maybe Trump would win. It was really funny because when we had Ben Jealous on, he was about to leave and we were wrapping up. And I jokingly said, we should tape two endings. It was the day of the election. I said, we should tape two endings in case Trump wins or
nice
Hillary
thinking.
Wins. Huh?
And he's like, why tape the Hillary one?
No, he was like, at this point, he was like, ha, 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 at this point. Fear the possibility that Trump wins. And then he goes through it. He talks about cicada voters, these voters who don't come out every election.
Oh, that's a good term.
Yeah, it's a good term, right? Unlikely voters.
Do you
voters.
Have cicadas here? So in Kansas City, they are...
We do, right? Okay, we do.
Incredible racket. I once made a tape recording of them.
What racket? I love that idea.
The noise.
Like
the noise that they make in August.
Oh, racket. I thought you meant like a business racket.
No, no,
okay,
no. They're up in the trees, like singing to each other, you know? And it's just the most incredible thing. And it goes on for like a month in the summertime.
Okay. That's not what he was referring to, though. But,
okay,
but
okay.
I do want to know more about cicadas.
There we have them every year, and they're the most incredible thing.
Right. But they only come out, what, something?
No, you're thinking of the 7-year locust, which is different.
I can't believe it's good thing this didn't come out before the election, or he would have been crushed by his opponents. He meant locust voters.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But they are a kind of cicada, so.
Oh, okay. Subgenre of cicada. Yeah. They're circadian. Anyway, they don't come out that often, so they don't get pulled.
Would
and
you
he was
drink
saying
that thing,
two
please?
Things,
you're driving me crazy.
What, with this thing?
Yeah. You're holding it up. Just like, do
well,
something with
all,
it. You're
first
making
of all, it was
nervous.
Upside down. The thing was upside down. This is why, like Sarah Palin, I need a rider in my appearances. Anyway. All right, I'll put this down. Gosh. Do you like this setup, by the way? It's around one fern. Instead of between two ferns. So yes, you guys were the. I'm going to call you right now for the first time. Pretend I used to do it. The Three Musketeers.
Ha, that's
you,
nice
Ben Jealous,
of you.
And Michael Moore. I'm sure I'm leaving out a lot of people, including women. So I apologize. It takes a village, guys. You like that callback?
Sorry.
You like my callback? It takes a village
Hillary,
to Hillary.
Yeah,
Clinton,
to Hillary. Yeah, yeah,
which
yeah.
The best part of that, make sure you reread the section where she waxes poetic about using prison labor.
Yep.
One unusual aspect of living in the Arkansas governor's mansion was getting to know prison inmates who were assigned to work in the house and the yard. When we moved in, I was told that using prison labor at the governor's mansion was a long-standing tradition that kept down costs, and I was assured that the inmates were carefully screened. Now, I had defended several clients in criminal cases, but seeing them in jail or in court was not the same as encountering a convicted murderer in the kitchen every morning. I was apprehensive, but I agreed to abide by tradition until I had a chance to see for myself. I learned a lot as I got to know the inmates better. We enforced the rules strictly and sent back to prison any inmate who broke one.
Yeah.
So I missed that. I actually did reread that book, but I went through it pretty fast.
Right.
And I missed that nugget. But for Listen Liberal, I had to read all that stuff.
So how did you go from being
the best book about her, by the way? Carl Bernstein wrote a wonderful biography of her, and there's parts of it that make you really sympathetic to her.
Yeah.
And you know, she's this Midwestern girl from not totally humble background, but a very like Charlie Brown and Lucy and Linus, you know, this sort of perfect Midwestern suburb in the post-war era. And I would have liked to hear more of that on the campaign trail.
Right.
Anyhow, that was all, that seemed to get lost. You know, do you want to hear another joke about Hillary?
Yeah.
How she could have won. This is my joke for how Hillary could have won Kansas.
That was our live taping with Thomas Frank. And to hear the rest of that interview, and it gets really good, gets a little rowdy. There's some references to Scrota. Plural of scrotum. Become Patreon members at patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow, and you will hear the rest of that interview.
And leave us a review.
Oh my gosh, guys, you can find The Katie Halper Show on SoundCloud, on iTunes, on Patreon. And at Patreon, you just become members and you'll really enjoy it. You'll be really happy that you did it. And that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. And on iTunes, leave us a review. You can make it short. You can make it long. You can do whatever you like. You can do whatever you like. You know? Just a little callback. So we will see you next week.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.